What I would like to do today is first I'll just read through the Mishnah so that we remember what we're talking about and go back into the Gemara where we left off. Excuse me, my goal is perhaps we'll succeed tonight to finish chapter 4 of the Gemara. We may succeed tonight to finish 4. If we finish 4, we will start next week with 5. Chapter 5 is a wonderful chapter, as 4, I hope you have found 4 to be an amazing chapter. 5 is similarly, and 5 is a different subject, but it's also related to economics. 5 is Ezo Neshech. What is the definition of interest? And it is all the laws concerning interest, whether one can charge interest. The answer to that is you can't charge interest. And then how can you have an economic system, of course, if you don't charge interest? How can you borrow money? So that's the subject. And there is also in Chapter 5 some extraordinary agadah. As we were treated to that in Chapter 4, Chapter 5 also has some wonderful agadah in it. And not too far in, so I'm not sure how far we'll get to toward the end of the year into 5, but we'll probably get to some of the very fascinating cases of Agadah. Okay, now just to review, I'm going to read the Mishnah straight through. Ein me'arvin ferot beferot. One does not mix literally vegetables with vegetables. Afilu chadashim bechadashim. Even new vegetables with new vegetables. The ein tzalich lomar chadashim liyishanim. And I don't have to say, of course, mixing new ones with old ones. Be'emet amru, the yayin hitiru la'arev kasheh barach. In truth, they said, as far as wine is concerned, they did allow mixing. They permitted mixing of strong wine with weak wine, putting the strong wine into the weak wine, yineshehu mashpicho, because that improves its quality. It improves its quality. Ein me'arvin shmarei yayin v'yayin. One is not allowed to mix up the dregs of the wine with the wine. Aval notein lo et shmarav, but one can put its dregs in it, whatever that means. Mi shenitarev mayim liyeno lo yimkarenu b'chanut. A person who mixes water with his wine shall not sell it in a store. Ela in kein odio, unless he announces to the person who will buy it, and this is not going to mean the storekeeper, that it's cut wine. Velo le tagar, he can't sell it to the tagar. Yeah, now that's maybe an important term, tagar, that it's not necessarily the mocher. It's not clear who the tagar is. The tagar, we have seen before, is a technical term for a middleman. Sometimes it's a merchant. But we've seen it in the chapter. Sometimes there's been a distinction between a tagar and somebody else engaged in commerce. We saw that earlier on. I think they're odio, below the tagar, afal pisha odio, even though that he tells the tagar, she'eno elo l'ramoto, because the tagar will surely take advantage of whoever he's selling it to. Makom she'nagu la'atil mayim b'yayin yatilu. Where it is the custom to cut wine with water, they can cut wine with water. Hatagar notel mehe granot, a tagar, again the same term, it's probably a wholesaler, is permitted to take from 5 silos. Vinotem letoch migura achat, and or five threshing floors, not silos, and put them into one silo. Nehegitot, from five vats for making wine, v'natan letoch pitom echad, and put the wine into one cask. Uvilvad shelo yehe mitkaven liarev, as long as, whatever this means, he doesn't intend to mix. It obviously doesn't make too much sense, so it must be something, some special conditions are referred to here. Okay, now go over on 60A1, on the right side of the page. The Gemara picks up this, I just read through the Mishnah quickly without doing much explanation, and we're now on the right side of the page, where it says, Be'emet amru b'yayin itiru l'arev kasheberach. In truth, they said, itiru l'arev, that you can mix strong wine into the weak, mipnei shehu mashpicho, because it improves its quality. Okay? Now, the Gemara goes on, and the Gemara says, Amar Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi Elazar says, Adda Amara, Adda Amara. Now that's Aramaic, in all likelihood. In Rashi, let's see, where is the Rashi? Oh, it's about halfway down the page in the Rashi, a little lower than halfway down the page. The last word on the line is Adda. Adda, Ayin, Adda, Amara. Now, Adda, Amara could mean Al, Ze, Amra. In other words, on this, they said, or it said, or something like that. Rashi says, Zotomeret. Zotomeret, okay? That is to say, Kol Adda, Hu Hadda. This is Rashi's translation of the Aramaic. All, wherever Adda appears, it means the same as Hadda. Hadda in Aramaic means this. Okay? So Adda Amara is Zot Omeret. That is to say. And here the Gemara says something of a legal significance. Kol Be'emet Amru. Wherever we have the phrase Be'emet Amru, in truth they said, Halachahi. That is an indication of the fact that this is the Halacha. This is the Halacha. So this is a phrase which we find sometimes in the Gemara, Be'emet Amru, and it has strong, it has real force to it. Now, we have frequently remarked that we seldom see the halacha discussed in the Gemara itself. And sometimes we see it deduced, or we come to a conclusion, or the argument ends, and we make an assumption, as the halacha said, made an assumption that once the argument ends, probably the ending is the halacha, or it would have gone on. But that's not always true. Here, you have an instance where, in fact, we see that this is halacha. What we don't know, however, is why this is halacha. And about that, there is much discussion among the Shanim, the early commentators, because the question is that because this is so logical? I mean, let's see what they're talking about. Remember, this is
mixing the wine.
Let's read the whole thing. This is Be'emet Amru. In truth, they said, B'yayin itiru l'arev kashabarach. With wine, they permitted the cellar to mix stronger into the weaker wine, mipnei shehu mashkicho, because it makes it, it improves its quality. Okay? Now, there are two things to note here. Number one is that you have a statement where we know what the halacha is. That's what we're learning from this, from the Gemara. We know what the halacha is. But there's also something unusual about this. not only that we know that it's halacha in the Be'emet Amru, but there are two ways to know halacha. First of all, it could be what I frequently would call an apodictic statement. That is to say, it simply legislates, and it tells you that this is halacha. But that's not what goes on here. Here, it says, Be'emet Amru, they tell you what halacha is, and then it says, Mitnei Shemashpicha, because it improves the quality. So in a way that makes it's both easier and more complicated at the same time. It's easier to understand why there is this forceful statement, Ben Metamru, in truth they said. But we're really not sure whether that would apply, let's say, to all other cases, where the reason is given, because here, in fact, the reason is given. It's Ben Metamru, and then it says, Mithnesha, because of. So this I'd like some of the commentators to say that this is a very strong statement. And there are those who say that Maimonides viewed such a statement, Be'emet Amru, to mean that this is equivalent to Halacha Moshe Mi-Sinai, to the law that goes back to Moses on Mount Sinai. I frankly don't understand it that way. Because it seems to me that once you give a reason, in a way what you are doing is the law that goes back to Moses on Mount Sinai is best understood where there's a certain irrational element to it, or at least an element that you have to ascertain, and you know it on the basis of tradition. Here, it seems to me the way this is approached is that it is because it makes sense. It makes sense, and therefore you would learn a principle from this. The principle is that when you are improving the quality of something, it is permissible to change that something, and that's not necessarily obvious. We had a lawyer here 2 weeks ago, your friend who was here. I mean, he pointed out that that's not the case in American law. That's an interesting observation. And it is true, if you change something, there's very good reason to say you can't change anything. But here you see a basic assumption that if you change something for the better, the assumption is that the buyer would be pleased with that. He's in effect getting more for his money. It's not an obvious assumption, but that it seems to be the case here in the Gemara.
But that's in contrast to what we learned, that you don't pray more. That what is stipulated is what you do, and there's no reward
mm-hmm.
for additional prayer.
That's true. Here you're in an area of law where, in fact, reason is very important in the manufacture of law. And that's the way I read this. I think that reason is quite important. And we will see here that, in fact, what we are learning in this part of the chapter is that you cannot deceive. Deception is what is wrong, and there's a certain equity to the notion of deception. That is to say that everybody understands, or everybody should understand, that it's inappropriate to deceive. And you don't actually need scripture to prove that. You don't need scripture to prove that. Logic proves it. So I'm underlining the value and the importance of logic here. Whereas, for example, when we get to the next chapter, Ezo Neshech, when we're dealing with the issue of interest, you will see immediately, and by the way, if we get that far, you might want to read the introduction to that chapter here in the Arts Kol Talmud. It's a very fine introduction, very thoughtful. What they point out is that interest itself is not something that there's anything wrong with. There's nothing wrong with interest. There's something wrong with usurious interest. But the laws against interest are not laws against usurious interest. They're not against excessive interest. They're laws simply against interest of any kind. Of any kind. Now, laws like that are really not logical. Because they're not designed to protect people. Right? Here we are dealing with an area of law which is logical. And where the purpose of the law is generally assumed to be generally understood. Right? And to my mind, that is the force of Be'emet Amru. Be'emet Amru. Be'emet Amru means that as a matter of equity, as a matter of reasonable people who are trying to understand the meaning of law, be'emet, as a matter of truth. And truth is something that's universally applicable and understood by everybody. Be'emet amru. In this case, this is an application of reason to the law as it applies in everyday life. Okay? That's my sense of the force of be'emet here.
I want to go a little bit to the Sheino El Aleramot on the issue of Betagar.
Okay.
This is, I think, this is on Advarim for the whole section of those people who are Tagar.
Mm-hmm.
How they can write something like that. In the,
explain what you mean. Why is it on Advarim?
We studied it, we cannot do on Advarim.
Right.
Means I cannot tell somebody who am I.
Uh-huh.
And here they write that the whole section of Tagar, El Aleramot. So this.
Oh, it's actually much worse than that.
Advarim up front to a complete section of the industry.
So, well, I would say it's even worse than Ona Advarim. Ona Advarim, we have seen, I think, in some of the examples that we've noticed, can be perfectly true. It can be perfectly true.
Yeah, but you shouldn't say it.
But you shouldn't say it, exactly. But life is such that, particularly in business, certain things may become in practice. Right? So more than Ona Advarim may be a matter of lying. You're not allowed to lie. Now, there may be a number of reasons why you're not allowed to lie. First of all, the Torah may tell you that you're not allowed to lie. That's reason number one. Okay? It says, Midvar Sheker Tirchak. You shall distance yourself from a matter of lying. Alright? So, that's one reason. Another reason, I'm simply trying to introduce another dimension into it, it may be that it is independently ascertainable that it is not good to lie, even without the Torah. Okay? So I'm just saying, you're right, you could see this as on a Advarim. I think there's something even more serious involved with the Tagar. With the Tagar.
I think one question I would have is whether or not the explanation isn't, in fact, parenthetical to avoid misconstruing the meaning of the law under the in truth statement. So, to sort of play that out, you say, in truth, in the case of wine, they are permitted, and that's the law. And now, for fear that someone might misinterpret that as having bearing, precedential or equivalent...
But then the previous case, right.
In another setting,
correct.
They then add this as a parenthetical thought,
right.
Not because it's the nature of the force
no,
of
that's
law
a good
to
point.
Avoid confusion about
yeah,
precedent.
That's perfectly, that's a very good thought. Yes?
I'm wondering, particularly since this section deals with food products, including wine, if I'm thinking of Jewish law, thinking religious law, which to me is something you don't have to have an explanation, there may be no explanation. So the laws of kashrut, we don't think you have to say, well, shellfish could have this.
Correct.
And so a civil law would reflect community values. And here you have a situation where you can't deceive people by watering down the wine. You can't even sell a retailer watered wine if you tell him, because he's going to just try to take advantage of people. Except in a community where people are in the habit of drinking wine that's been reduced with water. So I'm wondering, there is an element in here of the laws of kashrut where you really have to be, you don't have to give an explanation for why on Pesach certain rules have to be followed. And at the same time, there are rules here which do require some footnote at least to say, well, yes, this is not permitted unless, of course, everybody says, well, that's fine with us. So it is It's not a very well defined area the way I read it.
But it is different from, as you said, the laws of Kashrut or the laws of Pesach.
Well, in some way it is, and in some ways it isn't.
That's true.
It is different because they do try to explain to you here the mechanics of how it works. You can't do it, but you can't do it, and here's when you can, here's when you can. But the overall picture, I agree with you, relates to honesty and truthfulness in behavior, but that's not something that that's something we accept
as a let's move on. Let's go a little bit further, because I think that we'll see a few other examples of this as the Gemara further defines the terms. Right? Amar Rav Nachman. Rav Nachman says, "Ubein agitot shanu." When they said that it is permissible to mix the strong wine with the weak wine, that's ben agitot. That's only in the case of literally between the vats. Between the vats, benagitot. Now I'm going to read the Rashi here again over on the left side. It's just the next Rashi. Benagitot shanu, demashbicho. When they taught that it improves the quality, that is in a case shetosasim ze im ze. When they ferment this with that, when they are both involved in fermenting together, the nasim ta'am echad, and they become one taste. They become one taste. Avaliachar gitat, but after the stage of the vat, shekfar kalat kol echad rechov v'ta'amo, when each one has absorbed its taste, its own particular taste, and its fragrance, the ta'amo ein mashpicho, at that point, you can't mix them together, because that doesn't improve their quality. Ela pogmo, it rather decreases the quality. So here, it's a fascinating Rashi. Realize that one of the values of Rashi is that Rashi did this for a living. Rashi was a vintner. He was a vintner in Champagne. So this is one of those Rashis where you see Rashi in action. So if you mix things together, and assume that he knew what he was talking about, and that the Gemara also knew what it was talking about, and you know, Rashi is just so wonderful in a case like this because they're all on the same wavelength, on the same page. Here, the interpretation is, if you mix the things at an early stage of the game,
while in process,
exactly, and there's fermentation going on, and at a certain point that fermentation is done, the job is done, the wine is the wine. I don't know exactly how you make wine, but at that point, you can't mix them together then, because that just ruins the taste. Well, at an early stage, when all of this fermentation is going on, at that point you are permitted to mix them together. So it's again something that improves the quality and doesn't detract from the quality. And Rashi was very sensitive to what that meant. But now look what the Gemara says: V'ha'idin dekama arve shelo benegitot. But now this is reflecting, simply reflecting the reality of Babylonia. Now that people mix these things together, shalobe nagitos, not while it's in that. In other words, they must have finished the production of the wine. And in fact, then they would mix wine at that point. At that point they would mix it. As for example, you have that frequently when you buy a bottle of wine today. you can find a wine that says Cabernet Merlot. Okay? So it's a mixture of Cabernet and Merlot. I don't know what that means. I don't know whether that means that those are two different types of grapes that were fermented together, or whether it means that the two different types of grapes were fermented separately and then they were mixed together. I honestly don't know which it is. Maybe some of you know more about that than I do. But that was what they were doing in Babylonia. And so they said, well, how can it be then that we do that? We do it, and you're not supposed to do it. Right? Amar Rav Papa, the Yad Deva Kamachle. The first answer is, people know that this is going on, and they're forgiving. So in other words, the problem here again is deception. If people know what you're doing, and they have no expectations, you know, and they don't think that one thing is happening and another thing is happening, well, then it's okay. So we're back to now a reasonable explanation. It is, again, a case of what is equitable in the circumstances, what is proper in the circumstances, and we are mainly concerned about deceiving people, and if people know, then it's okay. Because that's what we're worried about. Rav Acha v'rei de Rav Ika Amar. Rav Acha, the son of Rav Ika, says, Hamani, whose opinion is it that we follow today, that we blend the wines even after the fermentation is over? Rabbi Achahi, it is the opinion of Rabbi Acha. Detanya, Rabbi Acha quotes then a Tanya, which is a Baraita. Rabbi Acha matir b'davar anitam. Rabbi Acha permits mixing things in the wrong way, you know, in a way that would damage them, because b'davar anitam, because wine is generally tasted before it's purchased. It's a fascinating statement about their reality, and one of the reasons that it interests me so much is that we still have the same custom. You go to a good restaurant in New York, they open a bottle of wine, you buy a bottle of wine in the restaurant, what happens? First thing that happens is that they pour you a little bit, whoever is the person who is in theory the master of what's going on, they pour you a little bit of wine, you're supposed to take a taste of it, and of course the reason for that is that if there's something wrong with it, you can send it back. I know, sometimes I taste, you know, I go through this, I taste it, I don't really like it, but I'm so embarrassed to send it back that I say, well, it's not that bad. So I'm not kind of, but obviously wine and the tasting of wine before paying for it, these customs go way back into ancient times. Because this is a detanya. This is a detanya. The detanya is, that goes back to the second century or before. So this has obviously always been a custom in the consumption of wine, that it would be tasted before you would pay for it. Okay?
Why is it understood or assumed that strong wine is good and weak wine is not?
I would say it's obvious. Because it tastes better. It tastes better. Okay? Now, of course, you could say, well, some people like weak wine. Okay? In which case, of course, the reason that we got here, you know, if certain things are obvious, then it doesn't matter. Or if there are certain customs, people can agree on anything they want. And ultimately, the problem is one of deception. But as far as the mevinim go, the cognoscenti, as we would say in English, as far as the cognoscenti go, stronger wine, at least in terms of their wine, whatever their wines were, it's not necessarily, I'm not saying that that's true for us today, but it does reflect the reality they were dealing with. Yes?
So I take it then, if you were to water down wine and sell it cheaper, be okay, because the wine would have an added value, okay, be subtracted from the quality, but it would be enhanced, okay, because of the was of the bright clean level.
As long as
it was advertised.
As it was advertised as such, correct. Correct.
Because they say the emet, and you can say in Hebrew, al ve'emet means in reality. Could be that since this industry of winemaking, which wasn't Jewish or Israeli at that time, was the old Middle East concept of doing it, the halacha took it as halacha because it was the real reality and there's no way to change it.
Very nice. I think that's a good explanation. It's a that's used, understanding the emet in the colloquial sense,
right.
Even as it's used today.
You didn't have any other option.
Well, it's not so far from what I was saying, that these are generally accepted issues of proper behavior in what I called equity.
Right.
That's possible. Yep.
And if we all get, those of you who've been to Pompeii, or you've seen fishes on Pompeii, we've seen bats of wine at the tasting bar.
Yes, they have a tasting bar in Pompeii.
In Pompeii.
You can see it in the, it's a tavern. It's a Roman tavern.
Right,
it's a Roman
tavern. So you have said they could have taken a spoon to taste.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Very good. Yes.
Wine has special significance because of its sacramental use.
True.
And
true.
The standardization, this is pre-FDA, you commented about this. I think that was more about standardization in law for regulatory purposes. And I would imagine they must have had some method of establishing whether or not a wine met the sacramental standard for use.
That's not only the two used in the temple, as you said, for a minimum. The answer is yes, you're right. I don't know that the standard is one. Just trying to think of where this is discussed in the Gemara. Rarely is. I don't remember being discussed in terms of quality. The most of the discussion on wine. I have to think about that. The wine discussion that I'm mostly familiar with has to do with the potential problem of the sacred wine being used for a non-sacred purpose, or worse yet, to be used for an idolatrous purpose. And there the question is whether you can have a Gentile pour your wine. That's a question kosher to today. Basic question in a kosher, in Oz Arua, for example. You notice that we put wine on the table when you come here. Wine is on the table so that you can pour it. We do not have other people pouring the wine because of the laws concerning the pouring of wine. These are laws that go back to the Talmud. Because of the fact that wine was so widely used for sacramental purposes, including pagans used wine just as much as we did. So there are many laws about such things. Interesting to keep in mind that whether the question of quality comes up in the sacramental purposes.
I don't know if it's apocryphal, but I was once told that the origin of the word proof for the alcohol concept goes back to Native Americans seeing if they could ignite the liquor that was given to them if it was still able to sustain being inflamed.
And that would be the proof?
And that would be the proof. But I don't know if that's apocryphal.
You know whether that's apocryphal?
No. That doesn't sound right to me anyway. But who knows? I guess the question I had, though, was in terms of the wine being sacrificial, and reading through all the Corbin, wine doesn't play any part of it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so if wine was such a sacrificial thing, you would think it would play the part in some of the sacrifice.
It does. It does play a part in the sacrifices because it's when you have in the Book of Leviticus, it's the korban unisacheha, nisacheha or niska, nun samach kaf, means it's libation.
It only comes at the end. It doesn't come. It comes at the end of Leviticus. All the korban that comes before that.
Mm-hmm.
okay, wine plays no part. The nesaf, okay, only comes in the drink offering, only comes in at the very, very end.
All right, let's pay attention to that. Let's further pay attention to that. Okay, anybody else? Yes. Sure, there was.
Well, I mean, it was like in the last 10 years, and it was.
In New York?
Well,
in New York?
You know, I'm going to have to Google this, you know, source, but I think it would be very helpful for us because it would really pinpoint.
No, I think I remember this exhibit. This was, I think it was in David's Citadel in Jerusalem that there was such an exhibit.
And I think there's a catalog from it.
Could be. Google it. See. Google it. Very interesting. Very good. Let's keep going. Okay. Right, now we come on with the Mishnah, more Mishnah. The Ein Arvin Shimre Yayin B'Yayin. We cannot mix the sediment, I call it the dregs of the wine, with the wine. Avon Noten Lo Et Shmarav, but the seller may put in its sediment. It seems to be contradictory. Aha, ma dresha ein avim klal. The latter part of the Mishnah says you mix them together. And in the first part of the Mishnah it says you can't mix them together. So how could it mean you can mix them together and you can't mix them together? It has to be one or the other. These are two contradictory statements. Okay? And then the Gemara does every once in a while. And if you want to solve this problem where we have two contradictory statements by hypothesizing the following, right? Mahi notem lo et shmarav. What does it mean to say that the seller may put his sediment in the kamodale? That is to say, he may do so only if he informs the buyer, because we see that that's, you know, basically, we see the that we're concerned about deception. So maybe the issue here is one of deception. But this can't be, because if you look at the structure of the Mishnah, it probably isn't referring to that. Why? At the end of the Mishnah, further on in the Mishnah, it says, Lo yim karenu b'chanut ela im kein moda o. There's a specific case brought to the end of the Mishnah. And he says, you can't sell it in a store unless you tell the buyer. Unless you tell the buyer. In relation to that specific case. L'tagar afal pi shemodi o. He may not sell it to a merchant even if he informs him. Even if he informs them. Miklal deresha afagav the lomodale. Which would imply then the earlier part of the Mishnah is actually talking about a different subject. Namely, it's not the issue of whether you inform or you don't inform. It seems to be dealing with something else and we don't know what it's dealing with. Okay? Amar Rav Yehuda hachikamar. Rav Yehuda says, this is how we can understand the issue of the sediment. Ein marvim shmarim shel emesh b'shel yom. We are not allowed to mix yesterday's sediment. Ein marvim shmarim shel emesh b'shel yom. In today's one. All right. So in other words, if you have sediment is not such a bad thing. A lot of good bottles of wine, you end up with sediment. You'll see that there is sediment on the bottom of a bottle. Doesn't mean there's anything wrong with that. No, that's just the nature of the particular wine. But to mix sediment from one to another is not good. Because it's got to be the same bottle. It's got to be this, or if it's a cask, it's got to be the same cask, whatever it is. Otherwise, you're doctoring up the wine itself. It's like doctoring it. Okay? Below shall yom b'shel emesh, and you can't put today's in yesterday's. Aval noten lo et shmarav, but you can put the sediment of a particular cask in the cask itself. Right? That's okay because it doesn't detract from the quality of the wine. So here's an issue simply of quality. It's not an issue. One might also expect another issue to come up here, that if you have sediment, the quantity will be less, because sediment takes up space. But that apparently is not what the Gemara is interested in. The Gemara is interested, again, solely in the issue of quality.
Rabbi, is it quality so much as purity?
In other words, the sediment is part of the original wine.
Correct.
But if you mix two different ones, either they can be concerned that the character is changing from one day to another, or that somebody might be tempted to sort of put a little more than, you know, really came out of that same wine and thus change the quality even further.
But well, why would you do that?
The sediment is from the wine itself.
Right. So that's okay.
You're just putting back together what was originally there. But if you do it from different days or different vats, then you could be changing the character.
Correct. So that's obvious, right?
Or somebody could be tempted, if you were allowed to do that, to actually overload it with even more sediment that happened to be lying around. So
I think it would, if it meant the latter of what you just said, it would have said that. But I think that the former, your first idea, is I think clearly what it is trying to say. I think that that's the point. Elaine, that come back to what you said.
The issue of
right.
Purity, basically, not right. Mixing. That's what is really paramount.
Well, I think my sense is yes, and there's a reason for that, because it has to do with quality. So it's not just an aspect of purity without the added reason of affecting the quality. Because sometimes it could be. I mean, just the purity could be a value in and of itself. Sure.
Isn't the wording of the sentence suggest a simpler explanation? In the first part it says, Ein ma'arvin shimre yayin b'yayin. You can't put the dregs, the wine lees, into the wine. Aval notain lo at shimrei, at shimrat. But you can give it to him. You can give the buyer of the wine.
As
lees. That were part of the original wine.
You may be right, but that's not what the Gemara says. It's a very different interpretation of the Mishnah, and it could be right, but it's not what the Gemara says.
No, I saw I was born a late to enter the discussion.
Yeah, had you been around, they might have benefited from that insight.
I realize.
Because certainly the Hebrew is good. You're right.
No, because the sentence doesn't make any sense. So, you can't, but you can.
Well, again, I think that what you're seeing here is the reality of life. It is reflecting the issues that concern them. They were in the business. Obviously, this was a business in Babylonia. And you see reflections of that business, and that's what I'm learning from it. I'm learning about the wine business. Here we go.
Just reading here in Steinholz, he makes it a statement in his interpretation that it's permissible not to strain the wine. So if you think about giving somebody a wine from the barrel, if you don't strain it, you're going to get some sediment. And what he's saying is that that's permissible. But if you go and add sediment from another barrel, that's already
very good. Nice. That's a very nice way to understand it. Very good. Very good. Excellent. Okay? We go on. Someone whose wine was mixed with water may not sell the wine in a store unless he informs each customer. Okay? And he can't sell it to a merchant, even if he informs him about the dilution. Okay? Rava aitu lechamra mechanuta. Okay, some people brought Rava wine from a store. So you have a case now. Some people brought Rava wine from a store. Mazgei tame. What Rava did was he diluted the wine and then tasted it. He dilutes it and he tastes it. Lo hava basin. He didn't like the way it tasted. Right? So, it's not clear whether it's because of the dilution or because the wine wasn't good. Remember that in the time of the Talmud, wine was normally bought and cut before it was drunk. I mentioned to you last time what the Mishnah says about the Passover Seder, that Mazgul lo kos rishon, we translate it as they poured for him the first cup of wine in the Seder. It doesn't mean Mazgul, doesn't mean pour really. We interpret it to mean that, but it means they mixed for him the first cup of wine, because they had very strong wine, and they would, it was so strong that it was not drinkable wine, that it simply wasn't drunk that way. And they would add water to it. So apparently he followed the normal custom of adding water to the wine, drinking, then tasting it, and he didn't like the way it tasted. Shadre lachanuta. So he sent it back to the store. Right? Again, we see that with wine, you taste it, and you can return it. So he sends it back to the store. But of course, what has he done in the meantime? He's diluted it. And we learned in the Mishnah, you're not allowed to, once you've diluted it, you can't send it back to the store, because now it's going back to a merchant. Right? And this is one of the rabbis giving it back to the store. So we might have assumed that if he's going to taste it and send it back to the store, it's before you dilute it. Now he's sending it back to the store. Okay? Amalei Abaye. Don't you remember what the Mishnah says? Right? You of all people, Rabbi, you should know what the Mishnah says. V'lola tagar afal pisha hodio. You're not allowed to give it to the merchant even if you inform him. Okay? How could you then have sent diluted wine back to the store? Amar le Rava says to him, Mizgadide meida yediyah. My dilution is easily recognizable. In other words, again, the problem is deception. When I have so diluted this that anybody who sees it won't think that it's wine. They'll see that it's very dilute, and therefore everybody will know. Again, we're back to the same issue. It's not as if the Mishnah is apodictic, that what it says goes in all circumstances. Rather, we're trying to protect people. And if, at least according to Rava, it's not just a matter of what the Mishnah says, because if people in fact are protected, then that's all we're concerned about. If it's obvious to everybody because of the strength of the dilution, it's so weak that nobody's going to make a mistake, right? Then in a way we're protected, because we were trying to protect the consumer. The consumer is protected because in its current state, it's obvious. Okay? Let's just go to the end. Okay? And Rava then entertains a possible objection to his answer. And if you will say that perhaps the storekeeper, right? All right, the way it is, no buyer will mistake it for wine that's not dilute. So every buyer is going to understand that. But you might say, since we don't trust the storekeepers to begin with, the merchant, you know what he'll do once he gets the dilute wine? He'll add enough wine to it so that it's no longer obvious. Okay? Because if he's corrupt, and we assume that the merchants are corrupt, there's a way to undo this. Alright, so Rava says now, Techitema de Tafi Michaile, if you say that perhaps the merchant will add more full strength wine to this and therefore strengthen the diluted wine, you'll hide the fact that it was diluted then. Im kein, ein la davar sof. He says, a case like that, there's no end to it. You can always, in analyzing a situation, think of something, even though it's perfectly logical, and we protected the consumer, you could say, well, what if? What if? There's no end to that. So it says we have to simply accept the reality of what happens in the marketplace and what most people will do and not create endless what ifs. Because if we have endless what ifs, we'll never know what the right thing is to do.
Sounds like this is the beginning of the prudent man.
Exactly. I think that's much of what we are seeing in this discussion. And maybe that's Be'emet Amru. In truth, they said. Okay? Yes?
Doesn't that directly contradict the Mishnah itself?
When sure.
The Mishnah says that someone whose wine was mixed with water may not sell it in the store. Isn't that exactly what he's done here?
And what I'm adding to this is I'm saying that the rabbis of the Gemara are understanding this entire Mishnah in terms of the reasonable man. They're trying to say what the Mishnah is doing is not simply giving us rules, but protecting consumers. And therefore, if the consumer is generally protected, in most cases, that's really what the Mishnah is getting at. It's limiting the circumstances, and that's why it's telling us what it's telling us. But if the circumstances change and the person is still protected, then we can't take the Mishnah literally. Now that's a very amazing thing for the rabbis of the Gemara to do with the Mishnah. It's not the only possibility they had. But I think it's of enormous significance that that is the way that they deal with the text. I think you're right.
Yeah.
It's a very liberal idea.
Yeah, and the spirit of this seems very different from the rules that we had early on, which were very strict about the precise fraction that you can overcharge, undercharge, or with the coins, the very, very precise fractions underweight. Here it's much more lenient in a sense, qualitative.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's
mm-hmm.
much less precise.
Mm-hmm. I would imagine, and I'm not sure what the details, but I would imagine all of this is reflecting reality. And that the first subject that we dealt with was money. And I would bet that what we're seeing is that money is just different from consumable quantities, even wine. And that people are or were at least concerned about the quality of the money they were receiving, money as a means of providing for transactions. And money then has its own unique character. And I think you're absolutely right. Money is dealt with differently. It's dealt with in a much more careful fashion, much more quantitative fashion. That probably reflects even the way we react to money. But we're in a different...
Also even the overcharging or undercharging, or underpaying, at the very beginning,
right.
The 1/6.
Right.
For the
fraction. Okay.
There, partly also that seemed to give some leeway. You could do a certain amount of overcharging,
yep.
But there were clear limits on where
mm-hmm.
you could go. Here, in part, it's also saying that in some cases, no mixing at all is acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
It's not even
sure.
allowing.
Realize.
Very different.
I think you're absolutely right. I don't think it's exactly the same by any means. I think it's different. And I think one of the things that we haven't seen in the discussion of this Mishnah is any reference whatsoever to Scripture. Right? There's been no quotation of Scripture. And that, too, is part of the way I'm reacting to it. The only thing we've seen in justifying the conclusions we've come to is this phrase Be'emet Amru. And I'm arguing really that that is different from Scripture. It's not the same. Early on with the issue of Ona'ah, Scripture was central to that. We had some scriptural verses and we had to apply those verses. And so it's almost by analogy we've moved on to other types of consumer protection, but it's really not the same. I think you're absolutely right.
Something is not logical with this example. Because when you buy a bottle of wine, real wine, which is Yain Kashe, and you bring it to the rabbi to taste it, you pour a little sample and you mozeg it with water, or memazeg the Yain with the water, and you taste it. You don't take the whole lot and you mix it and then you ship it back. This is somebody who has a lot of chutzpah to do. So something is not in...
I don't know the reality.
I mean, this guy...
To the contrary, I would say it's more likely that what they're talking about, they knew what they were talking about. We just don't know exactly what, whether there's big bottles, little bottles, casks, or whatever it was. I assume that when they have this discussion, it reflects a reasonable person's response in the context, or else it would have come up in the discussion. It wouldn't have held water in the argument between two people.
Yeah, it reminds me, lo kol ma shmutar l'rabbi mutar l'chassidim. I mean, he can do it, I can't.
No, you can. You can.
I'm not sure that if I will buy a lot, I can bring it back. You know, you sample and...
My understanding is that what would be permissible for the rabbi would be permissible for the student. Because again, we are dealing with equitable ways of treating people appropriately and not deceiving them.
There's one other technical way to deal with the diluted wine that's called evaporation. Is there any discussion of that? They must have recognized that.
Well, I think that's just in a way included in Rava's response, which is in and of ourselves. There's no end to the possibilities that you can imagine. Yes.
I don't know if it's very true or relevant, but I can't help thinking that this whole idea of not mixing two different wines, and I'm not talking dilute with water, but just the act of mixing, somehow echoes in my mind the laws of Shatnez. In other words, there is some ancient prohibition on mixing or combining two things or two breeds that don't belong together. Maybe because the wine has such a, it's been said, such a ritual function, maybe it has a special role here and a special need, the requirement.
I think my view is that would be overreading it.
You're
reading it anthropologically.
I couldn't help thinking about
that. I can understand that. Okay, let's go on. Makom shenagu la'atil mayim b'yayin yatilu, in a place where sellers are accustomed to put water into wine, they may do so. Tana, the Braita teaches, lemechse lishlish ulreviya. Up to a half, a third, or a quarter of the mixture may be water. Amarav uvenakito chanu. This was taught concerning during the time of wine production. Let's go on. Next mishnah. Rabbi Yehuda omer. Rabbi Yehuda says, Lo yechalek achenvanik laot ve'egozin latinokot. A storekeeper may not distribute toasted grain or nuts to children. Right. What is this equivalent to in our own time?
Peanuts.
Well, no, I don't think... peanuts, the way you mean it, peanuts that you could get... No, it's not, I don't think it's allergies. It's like getting... Yeah, it's candy. It's bubble gum. It's doing things, giving kids stuff.
To hook kids,
you give kids. If you're a storekeeper, you give free pieces of chocolate. When I was a kid, there used to be these little things on paper. They would give. You remember that?
Button candy.
Here you go. I hadn't thought of that in 50 years.
Sure. You can buy the length you want.
So I remember when I was a kid. Storekeeper would give that to kids. Kids would come in, you wouldn't pay for it. I mean, you could pay for it, but you get more. But there was a come on. There was a come on, so your mother would hang around the store. Because you would say, you know, let's go to that store. And because you were getting something for it, okay? So here it says, Lo yechalek achamani, a storekeeper may not give out toasted grain or nuts to kids.
Lives on in the lollipop in the diner.
The lollipop in the diner. Okay, that's what it is. Mipnei shohum margilon lavo etzlo. because that influences people to come to his store. So he's using something, not the quality of the products that he has, but he's simply tempting children so that people will go into his store. Okay? Interesting thing is, the Chachamim Matirin.
Right.
The sages permit it.
Of course.
Alright, so the Mishnah first forbids it. Alright, doesn't say what rabbi says it. It just comes without any attribution whatsoever. And then we see the sages reject that approach. The sages reject it. Well, we'll have to see. Lo yifchot et ha-sha'ar. A merchant may not lower the price of his goods. Probably the interpretation here is below the market price. Right? In other words, right. This is a merchant who is going to undercut everybody else and start selling things below the market price. So the Mishnah says that's an unfair thing to do in the marketplace. Look at what the sages of the Chachamim Omrim, the sages say, Zachula Tov. Bless them for doing that. It's a great Mishnah. It sets you up. I think, oh, this is very moral. It's a great idea. You know, shouldn't undercut all the other guys. And the sages come in and say, what's wrong with that? It's great. Exactly. Right. You know, no, Walmart is killing everything. It's killing everything. But what's wrong with that? You know, it's called a free work. It's a free market. You know, you can do what you want. And it's good. What's wrong with it? I buy my clothes there, you know. Exactly this kind of thing. Okay, Zachor Latov, the great line in Hebrew, Zachor Latov, bless your soul. Okay. Lo yavor et agrisin. He may not sift crushed beans to remove the refuse. Divrei Abba Shaul. Now, this is the case where the merchant is presenting his goods and he wants the goods to look unusually good.
Oh, it's the good cherry tomatoes on the top of the
house. Well, no, not necessarily that yet. Wait, we'll get to that. We'll get to that. But this is just where you polish all the apples. This is, to my mind, I call this the Dean and DeLuca case.
Yeah.
This is a Din and Deluga case. This is the perfect Din and Deluga case. Because you go in there and you look at the vegetables. Or it's a little bit Eli's, but Din and Deluga is the absolute case of this. You go in and you look at the vegetables. And they're apples. So I look at the apples. And I see the apples, every apple is like polished. It's beautiful. It's really very nicely, it really appears great. And I look at the price. Twice the price of the apples next door. Twice the price. So this is the type of merchandising where in fact the merchant presents the item, which is exactly the same item as the next merchant's item, but he polishes it up. So the Mishnah says here, Lo yavor et agrisin. You can't polish up your beans, in effect. You can't get rid of all the refuse. Divrei Abba Shaul. This is the opinion of Abba Shaul. The Chachamim, and one of the sages say...
Sure you can.
Matirin. Of course you can. Because what's the difference? If you want to pay more because those things look so nice, well, that's life. You can pay more. As far as the sages are concerned, they're not going to protect you from that. That's not the job of the law to protect you from spending more money. We just got to make sure the next guy, the guy next door, you know, he can do what he wants to do. But if you want to pay more for the same goods because it looks better, that's up to you. So as far as... What?
That's the cosmetic business. The money
you know a little about this business.
I know everything about
that. Did you hear that on the other side? He says, I know everything about that business. So tell us about that business.
The money's in the package.
The money's in the packaging. It's not in the quality of the product?
The quality product is in knowing...
Tell us the truth.
Money's in the packaging.
The money's in the packaging. Okay, very interesting. Very interesting. So, where, what would you be the head of?
I was the president of Revlon.
Here you go. All right, here you go. That's the proof. Okay, the sage is permitted. Chachamim matirim. Umodim shelo yavor ne'al pi ha'megora. But the sages agree that you should not put the polished apples on the top of the bin, what you were referring to before. Okay? Or the cherry tomatoes. So that the nice ones appear on the top, and you're going to buy all of them, or you're pricing, you're assuming that you're paying a certain thing because of what's on the top, and in fact, you're going to get something else. That's already deceptive. Okay, so that you can't do. The sages agree that in that case, you cannot clean up the product because you're trying to deceive somebody as a result of it. She'eno ela gonev et ha'ayin. It's a good Hebrew phrase. Because what you are doing is stealing somebody's eye. Gonev et ha'ayin is to steal somebody's eye.
Tarmit ayin, right,
is... In English, you would say what? You're deceiving. It's a form of visual deception. Visual deception.
So it's a beautiful parallel to the apple of your eye.
That's right. Nice. Very good. She'eno ela kegonev ayin. Ein mefarkasin, one may not beautify, lo et adam v'lo et behema v'lo et kelim, a man, which would be somebody, slave, for example. You can't dress the slave up. Whatever reality of that is referring to, and we'll see that later. Or an animal or utensils. Now, of course, that doesn't make too much sense with what we said just a moment ago, so we have to see what that's referring to. It must be referring to something very specific, or else it would make sense. Okay, let's go on. My tamayud rabbanan. In the case of the storekeeper who gives the button candy to the children, and the sages permit it, why do the sages permit it? The Amre Le, because the storekeeper can say to somebody else, to his competitor, Ana, Mifalikna amguzi. I distribute nuts to attract customers. At paliga shiste. You can distribute prunes. So in other words, it's a free world. If I want to give away button candy, you can give away chocolate. There's nothing wrong with a merchant doing that. It's not as if he has an undue advantage over the next merchant. Everybody's free to engage in this, and so it's perfectly fit. It's called competition, right? We have to we can compete with each other, and there's no undue advantage. Okay, that's the sage's reasoning. For lo yichot et shar v'chachamim amrim zakol atov, he can't lower below the price below the market price, and the sages say it's okay. My tam in the Rabbanan, what is the reasoning of the sages? Next page 60b1. It's reasoning of the sages. Mishum dekar marvach litara, because he lowers the market price. In other words, there's nothing wrong with lowering the market price. In truth, the market price is not just between one merchant and another. The entire market is connected. The entire market is connected. And market prices go up and market prices go down. If, in fact, the merchants will lower their price, well, then, in fact, the entire market price could go down for an object. And we're not concerned about market price. We're not trying to prop up market price. Whatever the market price it is, and of course, if this guy is selling, in effect, below the market price, then he loses. But that's what it is to be in business.
It's interesting that the sages took the position of the basic tenets of American competitive law, a monopoly law. The law is to protect the competition, not to protect the competitors. That's what they're saying.
Say that again?
The law is to protect competition.
It's
not
competition.
To protect the competitors.
That's correct. That is their position, exactly that. That's correct. Right. To maintain the competition, that is correct. And in effect, the market price is all part of that.
That shows that at that time everyone will push his own money, not push other people's money.
How would it be different?
Because that's a way to destroy the economy.
Well, if you...
If you reduced GM a few years ago, had a lot of money in the bank.
Right.
So they wanted to fight Ford. So they gave 30 months free loan to buy a car. I'm talking a few years ago.
Right.
And Ford got into huge problems.
Mm-hmm.
GM sold a lot of cars,
right.
But they never had cash to maintain themselves 10 years later.
Well, that's called the marketplace. That's called the
marketplace. When you play with other people's money, it's very smart. But when you do your own money, it's a different story.
That's being in a free market. That's being in a free market. You take risks. The question, you know, when you're in a free market, you live with risks. Okay? Yes, no?
I think a caveat with the competitive idea is the idea of what we have with antitrust laws is you're so big and you lower your price below the market price, then people can't fairly compete. So I don't know if you see any of that here, but
that's an interesting modern example. That's true. You can see where antitrust law would come from, because that's perfectly reasonable. It's a reasonable extension of this idea. This is dealing in a much simpler economy. I think you're quite right. And of course, we've just lived through and are still living through another spin-off of the idea, which is that there are certain businesses that are so crucial that we can't allow them to go under. And we all have to pay for that. That it's in our own best interest to make sure that certain businesses, in effect, are protected from the market. Because we're protecting ourselves that way. So that was one that a lot of people never thought of until a year and a half ago. And suddenly it began to dawn on
them. There are defense issues. GE developed the flat panel display, for example, and they moved the royalties to sell. Most of it was done by Hitachi for years. And it came to the point that the last manufacturer in the United States to produce flat panel display wanted to shut down and move to China. And the government forbid it to happen because most of the submarines and the marine industry has all flat panel display. And they couldn't, it came to the security issue.
That's another aspect of it.
And they stopped the process.
Yeah. Okay, good. We go on. ולא יעבור את הגריסים דברי אבא שאול וחכמים עתירים. Okay, this was the case of he may not sift crushed beans. These are the words of Abba Shaul and the sages. That's my Ian and DeLuca example. The sages permit that. And the Maharal says, Man Chachamim, who are the sages we're talking about? Rabbi Acha. Tanya. The Rabbi Acha has a baraita. Rabbi Acha matir b'davar nir'eh. We saw Rabbi Acha just a few minutes ago, if you remember. He was the guy who said that tasting things, that people, once you taste it, that's a proof, and that protects you. Similarly, Rabbi Acha has a similar view here. Rabbi Acha matir b'davar nir'eh. He permits enhancing the appearance of something through something discernible. Namely, if the eye sees it or the mouth tastes it, reasonable people can process that information and come to reasonable conclusions as a result of it. Okay? So that's much the way we think, I think, in the same fashion. Ein mefarkasin lo et adam velo et hakelim. Sellers may not beautify a man or utensils. It appears to be the assumption is here, you're talking about slaves and dressing up the slave. Odd case to bring. Tanu Rabbanan, rabbis teach in a variety. Ein mesharbetin et a behema. One may not make the animal's hair stand like a stick to make it look, a cow look like it's fatter.
Okay. You can go to Westminster. Okay. You can go to the kennel show. You know, the Westminster show's in store.
Well, I think that, I mean, I don't know how those things work. But again, this is an issue of what a reasonable person sees when he is making a purchase. And you can't do things that in fact deceive the reasonable person. So these are a number of practical examples in an agrarian economy where people did that. You're not allowed to blow into the intestines of an animal to make the animal fatter. I guess that's a kind of deceptive practice that people did. When they sell an animal, they blow up the animal.
Now the
movement,
not to
cruelty to animals? Right. Okay. But I suppose we're just seeing reality here. The ancient rimata basar b'mayim. You can't soak meat in water. And there the issue was probably that it makes it look like it has more fat in it. Because that's what the commentators say, that the meat has white lines in it if you soak it in water, and marbleized meat is more expensive. Marbleized meat is more expensive. Jay, you have a different sense?
I'm sure that the way we buy meat nowadays, if you take a piece of meat out from the butcher and put it in water, it doesn't look marbleized or better. It looks plain.
So what would be the issue? Shiny?
Maybe the color is deeper?
Yeah, maybe that it weighs more.
It weighs more.
It absorbs more.
Mm-hmm.
I honestly have no idea.
Okay. I couldn't tell you.
I mean, if you put it in a reasonable amount, you wouldn't figure it out. It weighs more.
But Jay, I think that they're talking about visual things to make it look more attractive. I think that's the cool thing.
Yeah, that's true.
So maybe it's a deeper color.
I would respect that. That's the way I would read it.
All these laws of what you call it are part of the body and soul of the Federal Trade Commission.
Exactly. You see where they get it from, or they start with where these things come from. Okay, come on, I want to finish. My ein mishar betin. What does it mean to say that you're not allowed to make the animal's hair stand like a stick? How do you do that? Hachatagamu maya de chizra. Here, and here again you're seeing realia. Here, namely in Babylonia. So here they actually define, this is what it means, because this is a reality that we deal with. Hacha, right? Targamu maya dechisra. It means giving the animal the broth of bran to drink. Ze'iri amarav kahana miskafta. Ze'iri said in the name of Rav Kahana that it means brushing the animal's hair. So obviously they weren't sure exactly what was meant by the Mishnah or by this Baraita, which comes from an earlier time, and they're simply interpreting in terms of the reality of their own animals and the way in which they know when an animal's up for market, how people try to pretty up the animal and end up deceiving the buyer. Okay, now the Gemara goes on to say things that are okay. Shmuel shara l'mirma tumis l'sarbala. Here the Gemara gives us the opposite. It says, Shmuel permitted sellers to attach silk fringes to a coat to make the coat look more attractive. So in other words, you can make certain changes, but not other changes. You can make changes that are generally acceptable, where you're not deceiving people. If you're going to sell your apartment, you're going to sell something, generally what you do is that you make sure it looks nice. There's nothing wrong with that. We're not saying you can't make something look nice. You can't make it look as nice as it is able to look. What we're saying is that you can't deceive as a result of that. And there's a difference. There may be a fine line. Rav Yehuda shara l'chaskuse karame. Rav Yehuda permits sellers to starch decorated garments when making a sale. So you can starch them. Rabba Shara Lenedak Srade. Rabba permitted sellers to beat canvas to make its fibers look better. Rabba Shara Letzalume Gire. Rabba permitted sellers to paint arrows. I have no idea what that means. Rav Papa Bar Shmuel Shara Letzalume Dikule. And Rav Papa Bar Shmuel permitted sellers to paint wicker baskets. So in other words, when you're selling different things, you can paint them the way you like. And you might have thought that you can't do that from the Mishnah. But here we're saying that you can do it. Now, so the Gemara says, Ha'anan Tanan, but doesn't it say in the Mishnah, Ein Mefarkasin, sellers are not allowed to beautify a man, an animal, or utensils. And here you just told me that the rabbis are permitting that. Doesn't the Mishnah say you can't do it?
Different
rabbi. La kasha. One thing refers to new items, another to old items. The real issue here is an issue of deceptive practices. At what point do you cross a line between appropriate and good presentation and deception? That's the issue.
Now, I keep thinking of that case that they had with the Campbell soup several years ago in advertising where it said it was a chunky soup or something, and they had put clear marble on the bottom of the bowl with the soup, so that it looked denser and it looked like it was more, the vegetables grew up on the top and everything, and they were sued for the.
This is basically deception advertising. It's truth in advertising is what we're reading about here exactly.
Does how much you donate to the rabbi depend on whether you can or cannot point arrows or paint the wicker basket?
I would hope not.
I
would hope that's not relevant. I hope it's simply a truth in advertising issue here that. You can make, if you're selling your cameras,
yeah.
Right, you know that to sell your cameras, you want them to look as good as they could look, right? You want to present, that's perfectly fine. You can put them in nice boxes, right? At a certain point, though, there may be a level of deception. It could be the size of the box, that you have a big box and a little thing, and people are buying it expecting to get a big thing and not a little thing. Or maybe that's not the issue. Whatever it is. These days, I find that in buying cereals. This is an issue. In these days, when you buy a box of cereal, maybe half the box, a third of the box, is the size of the cereal. And I read that people say that this is okay. But that's obviously trying to deceive people. Seems to me it should definitely be prohibited. Because you're doing it to deceive people. And I saw that people are willing to be deceived, they said, because even if you tell them, they want to buy a bigger box. And they're actually happy when they get less stuff because it won't make them so fat. It's the shit in the world we live in. Crazy things, yes.
I agree about the cereal, but I'm not sure about the types of merchandise. To me, it makes sense that there's a fundamental difference between what they refer to as utensils or as slaves. Basically, because I had read ahead, and I was thinking of things that age. So, for example, these days, a car would fall into that category, too, where you couldn't, I would imagine, just hypothetically, it would be wrong to, or considered wrong, paint a car as if it were new when it's an old car because it ages, and so when they give examples of a slave or certain utensils or animals, those are to me different than
good point.
Other objects.
Good point.
So,
that's a good point of analysis. Absolutely. Good. Let's finish up. Pirkus the Adam Maihi. Interesting little end piece here. What does it mean to talk about beautifying a person, a man? And here the Gemara gives you a story. It's an amusing story. Like the incident of a certain elderly slave, the Azal Tzave Lereshe Uledikne, went and dyed his hair on his head and his beard black. Atalakame the Rava. He came in front of Rava to sell himself. So this is a Babylonian story. Okay, this is a story about Babylon. Right, he comes in front of Rava to wants Rava to buy him. Amale Zidnan. He says to Rava, buy me. Okay? It's a bizarre story. Amarle, he says to him, Yu aniyim b'nei beitcha. He answers him with a phrase from the Torah, from the Mishnah, may poor people be part of your house. That is to say, I don't buy slaves. If I need people, in effect, what is he saying? I'll hire somebody. I'll give a job to somebody, and I'm not going to buy a slave. And unless it's kind of an amazing statement, I think really what he's doing is rejecting the notion of a slave. Really rejecting the notion of a slave. Now the slave, of course, has fixed himself up in order to look like a young slave. All right, now it goes on. Atalakame the Papa Bar Shmuel. The slave came in front of Rabbi Papa Bar Shmuel. Zavne, who bought him. All right, so this other rabbi buys him. Yomachada Amale. One day Rabbi Papa Bar Shmuel said to him, Ashkian Maya, give me some water to drink. Azal Chavre Reshe Levitne. Slave then rinsed off all the black stuff. He rinsed off all the black stuff, and he showed him that he was a Amale Chazi Da Ana Kashishi Meabuch. Can't you see that I'm older than your father? Which is to say, now I don't have to do anything. You want me to do it, but you have to respect an old man. Doesn't matter whether an old man is a slave or not. You can't tell me to do things. Right? So then the Papa Bar Shmuel then says, Tzadik mitzara nechlatz biyavo acher tachtav. A righteous man is rescued from trouble, but somebody else will always come and take his place. In other words, the first rabbi did the right thing. And there's always, how do you say it in English? There's always a fool around the corner. There's always there's a sucker born every minute, and I'm the one. So I shouldn't have done it. The first time I was righteous. He never should have bought the slave in the first place. I'm looking for a good deal. I'm getting this guy, and I struck out. Okay.
The earliest reference to dying hair.
No, there are actually numerous references to dying hair for old people who want to look young. Oh, the year of the Talmud. So it's sometime in the first 5 centuries.
Finding the first gift basket here? Painted gift basket?
Maybe. Okay.
Do they have a concept of kosher and non-kosher wine?
Yes. Okay, to be continued, we will go on to chapter 5. Shakoach, everybody. We finished chapter 4.